Good afternoon, and welcome to today's Deloitte Fireside Chat, focused on responsibility for preventing and detecting financial reporting fraud, broadcast live on www.sechistorical.org. I am Ira Solomon, R.C. Evans Endowed Chair in Business and Head of the Department of Accountancy at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. I will be the moderator for today's program. The Deloitte Fireside Chats are made possible through a partnership between Deloitte LLP and the SEC Historical Society. Deloitte is the brand under which tens of thousands of dedicated professionals in independent firms throughout the world collaborate to provide audit, consulting, financial advisory, risk management, and tax services to selected clients. The SEC Historical Society shares, preserves, and advances knowledge of the history of financial regulation through its unique virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. The museum is free and accessible worldwide at all times, and it currently welcomes more than 30,000 visitors a month. Both the museum and the society are independent of the U.S. Securities Exchange Commission and receive no funding from the public sector. The society is grateful for the generous support of Deloitte LLP in making the Deloitte Fireside Chats possible. I am delighted today to welcome Joseph Carcello, Ernst & Young and Business Alumni Professor of the University of Tennessee at Knoxville, Cynthia Fornelli, Executive Director, Center for Audit Quality, and a member of the Society's Board of Advisors, and Robert J. Kippers, Deputy CEO, Deloitte LLP, and a trustee of the SEC Historical Society. Before we begin our discussion, I'd like to state that the views of the presenters are their own and do not reflect those of Deloitte LLP or of the SEC Historical Society. The Society is responsible for the selection of the moderator and presenters. We have determined the questions that will guide the content of our discussion. And now off to the main event. We're going to start with a definition as we're focusing today on a particular kind of fraud. My first question will be directed initially to Bob Kippers. How would you define financial statement fraud?
Oh, thanks, Sarah. I think we could spend the hour on that, but let's not. Let me just posit a working definition as I think about it. If you think of financial statement fraud as a material misrepresentation resulting from an intentional failure to report financial information in accordance with GAAP or generally accepted accounting principles, that tends to hit on what we classically think of a set of materially false financial statements. And as we all know, the intent in addressing those kinds of frauds are the ones that really impact the capital markets in the most severe way, leading to an erosion of public trust, and from a company standpoint, a major financial reporting fraud can be devastating to the company's reputation, even to the point of jeopardizing its very existence. So I take that as the most serious form of fraud. It wouldn't include, you know, the minor misappropriation of assets. Every company experiences, expense report fraud or misuse of assets, but typically they are not material. So I want to focus on what I call the big stuff when it comes to financial statements.
Who plays a role and has a responsibility when it comes to deterring and detecting financial statement fraud, and what are the responsibilities of those groups? Cindy.
Well, Ira, thank you. And let me just for a moment add on Bob's answer to the definition of financial statement fraud. We at the Center for Audit Quality just recently on October 6th issued a report called Deterring and Detecting Financial Reporting Fraud, a Platform for Action. And indeed, we use that same definition that Bob articulated for our report. And what I would add to Bob's definition isn't really to the definition, but he mentioned other kinds of fraud. And I think that if you focus on ways to deter and detect financial statement fraud, you will find that those tools will be applicable to other types of fraud. And so if a company, for instance, has a robust anti-fraud program, then I think it'll permeate throughout the organization. So with respect to who plays a role and who has responsibility and what those responsibilities are, we at the CAQ focused on four key players, what we call the supply chain for responsibility in deterring and detecting fraud in an organization. And first and foremost, of course, is management. They bear the primary responsibility for deterring and detecting fraud within an organization. So they're responsible for internal controls, for having a robust ethical program, for establishing and maintaining the whistleblower program. Then, of course, is the boards of directors and the audit committees. And they have the responsibility for overseeing the business and control environment within an organization. Then, in our minds, became internal audit, if indeed that a corporation had that function. And of course, a listed company is required to have an internal audit function. They don't necessarily have to have an internal audit department. But they play a really key role in helping the company create the internal control structure within an organization. And then last but not least are the external auditors, who must be independent of the company and who provide a public report on the entity's annual financial statements. And so including for non-public companies over a certain market cap, an assessment of the effectiveness of an entity's internal controls over financial reporting. So one way that we've talked about it within the Center for Audit Quality is that it's a Deming model, and it starts with management and ends with external audit, and all four players bear some responsibility. And what we found is that collaborating and working together is a much more effective way of dealing with fraud within an organization and deterring and detecting it than each group trying to go it alone.
Cindy, let me put a finer point on that, because I think you've framed an extremely important model in this fine report. This is a very effective report. Too often when you analyze or do your postmortem on a failure, the headlines or the reports on it are that the audit committee was asleep at the switch, or the auditors weren't skeptical enough, or management was misrepresenting themselves with a particular skill. But to sort of place the responsibility on any one party exclusively ignores the reality that we all live within, and that is the system is designed for all of these players to, meet their responsibilities. And just to pick on two, the internal auditor is extremely important, and I understand every single company doesn't have an internal audit function, but those that do, the Institute of Internal Auditors professional standards require that the internal auditors evaluate the effectiveness of risk management and controls, and specifically call out the potential for the occurrence of fraud and how the organization manages that fraud risk. So if they're on their game, that is a piece of the puzzle that the internal auditors are responsible for. And when it comes to my profession, the external auditors, a lot of people are surprised to hear, it's sort of unfortunate, frankly, that, by our standards, an external audit, is designed to assess the fraud risk, but more importantly, is executed in a way that is designed to detect a material fraud if it were present. Of course, not only material fraud, but even misstatements that were by error or otherwise. But the point is, that is a responsibility. And what ties all these people together is sort of their common duty, I'll call it, or parallel duty to the investing public. I mean, every one of these people has a role.
Let me jump in a little bit here on this one as well, to just piggyback a little bit on what Cindy and Bob said. One of the things Cindy said is that senior management plays a role, along with the other three people that she talked about, and I think used the words most critical player or most important player, and I would agree with that. I think she's right on with that. In some work that I've done with that was sponsored by COSO with three other academics, we looked at fraud from late 90s to late 2000s, And one of the things we found, which is really a follow-up to earlier work we had done, is when there's material financial statement fraud that at least gets the attention of the SEC. Overwhelmingly, the CEO and the CFO are players in that fraud, at least alleged to have perpetrated the fraud, to the tune of about 89% of the cases. So when we talk about, and again, I'm completely on board with what Cindy said, that senior management is the most important player. But when we find fraud, they're often the ones who've perpetrated it, which makes it very hard for the other participants that Cindy talked about, the audit committee, which may be there four or five or six times a year for a day or two. Internal audit, granted they're there more frequently every day, and they are employees of the company. And even at the external audit, it's just much more difficult. Fraud is a strategic act, as we know, Ira, from the literature. And unless you have very incompetent fraudsters, right, a lot of times, you know, they're dishonest people, but they're pretty bright. And they're going to take extensive steps to hide what they're doing. As a result of Sarbanes-Oxley, the consequences of being caught are draconian. In all likelihood, Bernie Ebbers will die in prison, you know, sentenced to 25 years at age 65. And so if you're going to commit fraud, you have a very, very powerful incentive to hide it. Which makes it quite difficult for these other parties to detect it. So I think one of the things that should come out of this is it's very challenging to detect fraud.
Joe, I'm going to direct this next question right back to you as well. One of the parties that's been mentioned here, of course, is the independent auditor. And there has long been a gap between what the public believes the independent auditor's role is with respect to detecting financial statement fraud and what it actually is. If you could talk a little bit about how that gap has evolved over time and where it stands today, I think that'd be great.
Yeah, the gap certainly has been there for many years, as we all know in this room. I think there's different levels of perception gap, Ira. I think to the general public, quote-unquote the man on the street, they often think auditors are checking every transaction and looking at every document. And, you know, that's obviously unrealistic unless you're looking at the very smallest company. Even there, it probably doesn't make a lot of sense. And when you're auditing very big companies, you're looking at samples. And so the belief that all fraud, no matter how small, no matter how immaterial, is going to be detected is just wrong. Then there are more sophisticated users who I think understand that the auditor's responsibility is to, as Bob, I thought, very well explained, to detect any material misstatements in the financial statement, whether caused by error or fraud. Now, with that said, as I said earlier, detecting misstatements caused by error, I'm not going to use the word easy, but you don't have the client fighting against you. When I was in public accounting, they usually would lead us to those errors. They didn't realize they were errors very often, but they weren't hiding anything from us. With fraud, it's a very different animal. Some users understand that, and others don't. I think clearly there is a desire on the part of many users, whether they're individual or certainly the institutional investors that I've interacted with, for auditors to do more in this space. Bob and I served together, I guess, for about 4 years, Bob, on the PCAOB Standing Advisory Group. And that is a group of auditors and preparers and users, investors, some academics. And when we would discuss the finer points of auditing, often, particularly the investors, didn't seem too interested in the conversation. But whenever the conversation would turn to fraud, their level of interest really took a major jump up very quickly. And so I've heard investors say, if you can't detect material fraud, what good is the audit? You know, really, how valuable is that to us? Now, we could have a whole separate discussion about that. But clearly, there's a desire on the part of many users, many investors, to have the external auditor do better in this space.
Yeah, I think to Joe's point, what he's talking about is exactly right. In fact, I was at a AAA conference a while back, and one of the professors had an article from Victorian England in the 1800s that talked about the expectations gap. They didn't use those words, but clearly they were talking about what is the proper role for this external function in finding fraud and preventing fraud within a corporation. So I think this misunderstanding has lasted for a long time. But I think what's important and what Joe's comments highlight is the need for all of the parties in that supply chain, as well as others, regulators, academics, researchers, investors themselves, to have this ongoing dialogue and understand each party's roles and responsibilities and what they can do and what they should do, and making sure that all areas are covered. So that there aren't gaps, no pun intended, in the process, and understanding the process, and you know who's going to do what, so that we all work together to try to deter and detect fraud. You know, and one thing I'm noting is that you know our title of our chat today is the responsibility for preventing financial statement fraud, and unfortunately, given human nature, I don't know that we will ever fully prevent financial statement fraud. I think that can all be our aspiration, but given people that will have the pressure and the opportunity and the rationalization, the classic fraud triangle, I think we're going to continue to wrestle with this problem. So we really have to try to find ways to try to prevent it and then deter and detect it along the way.
Just a quick thought on the expectation gap. One of the things that I'm very focused on is, okay, so it's been around forever. It's probably never going to be gone completely. But how do we narrow it? How do we close it? And I think, to be a little self-critical, if I look at the profession over the 30 years I've been at this, you know, too often in the early part of those 30 years, we spent our time saying, well, people just don't understand the limitations on an audit. And so the main program was to educate those on one end of the gap so they would move closer to the middle. But I really think the only way to make true progress is to both increase the performance of the auditor to be more effective in more, you know, greater percentage of the cases, even when there's concealment, which is hard, as well as educating those that might have unrealistic expectations. But Cindy's got the key to it all, and that is if you engage, you can actually accomplish both, I think.
Well, we'll have a chance in a few moments to learn a little bit more about some of the recent innovations in audit practice that may help narrow that gap. But now what I'd like to do is direct another question to Joe, because the scholarly literature has some information in it for us about how and how well the independent auditor is performing with respect to detection of financial statement fraud. And so I'd like to ask Joe if he would give us a quick tutorial on what that literature has to say.
Yeah, thanks, Ira. There's, again, a lot of literature on this topic, as Ira certainly knows. And Ira was kind enough to point me in the direction of two papers not written by accounting professors, but economists and finance people. And they really are consistent with what we know from other sources as well. But generally, the external auditor is not not among the primary sources of detecting fraud. At least over their entire sample. What was interesting to find is that some groups that you wouldn't necessarily expect were quite important. Employees were important. Now, I think we could have probably predicted that, certainly with the advent of hotlines. Employees were quite important. But so were short sellers, which makes some sense. And, you know, they have an economic incentive. Economic incentives usually work. And the media. They don't have an economic incentive, but they have a huge human capital incentive. And so some of those sources were really quite effective. The positive news for the auditors is that post Sarbanes-Oxley, their performance increased by a factor of four. It was pretty dramatic. And so that's good. That speaks well to the profession, speaks well to the act, at least in that domain. Give the PCAOB some credit, maybe, and a lot of credit to go around. So that's a good thing. In another paper that the authors had, Dick Moss and Zingales, they also have some baseline statistics on how prevalent fraud is. Now they use a novel methodology that I won't go into here. And so you could certainly quibble with the methodology, and it's not hard. It's an estimate. But they estimate that it could be as high as 7% of public companies have new frauds beginning in any particular year, which I think if you had asked a typical person what the baseline rate of fraud was, and this is big public companies, above $750 million in assets, I don't think they would have picked a number that high. So if that 7% is even close to accurate, you hear a lot of complaining sometimes from various quarters about the expense of controls and the expense of auditors and the expense of, let's say, just various compliance-related activities. Well, if 7% of large public companies have new frauds beginning every year and they kind of documented the magnitude of the losses, it's 40% of firm value, 40% of median firm value if you have a fraud. So it's huge numbers involved here. So that to me is indicating that the economic rationale for doing more in this space is, I think, quite compelling. There's also other research. Again, I'm not going to try to run the whole litany, but some work by Joe Brazel and others on the use of non-financial measures to assess fraud risk. I know, Ira, you've done some stuff, some of the work you've done over the years. And you know, often what happens is the financial numbers are misstated, but often the company doesn't go back, the perpetrators don't go back and backfill operating data. And so then there's a disconnect between the operating metrics and the financial metrics. And so I think that's promising. And so there's some good work being done in academia on some of these things, both descriptive and then trying to help us get better, as well as, I'm sure, things that are being done inside the firms that we may hear from Bob and Cindy about later.
Joe mentioned the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. I'd like to ask Bob and Cindy both to tell us from their perspectives what effect the Sarbanes-Oxley Act has had with respect to prevention and detection of financial statement fraud. Bob?
Well, Ira, funny you mentioned that. I have sort of a strong view on this. You know, we know it as the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, but I could have renamed it the Sarbanes-Oxley and Anti-Fraud Act of 2002. The reason I say that is it actually touches on a lot of the constituencies that we mentioned earlier. You know, with respect to management, we've got the certification requirements, which, you know, from the clients I visit, that's a pretty big deal. I mean, this is pervasive in the organization to get sub-certifications usually and have that roll up because of the responsibility of the CEO and CFO, coupled with stronger penalties for crossing the line, criminal penalties, and that's not a minor point. And then you take, most importantly, the management report on the effectiveness on internal controls over financial reporting and the companion piece, which is the auditor attestation of that. Now, not for everyone, but certainly for the large issuers. And as we now know, the Dodd-Frank Act that just passed earlier this year has limited, the 404B piece, I think regrettably, because I find that there's direct correlation between the discipline that those internal control requirements, you know, have on the larger company and the, at least my perception of what the incidence of fraud is. I think it's much harder to commit a fraud if you've got an effective system of internal controls over financial reporting. It also touched on the audit committee with the financial expert requirement, having that expertise and direct oversight of the external auditor plus the whistleblower programs. I mean, you take that as a package, and even though maybe that wasn't the driving force at the time in 2002, it certainly had the impact of really, you know, I think effectively reducing the incidence of fraud.
Yeah, adding on to that, as we were preparing to put this report together, what we did was at the CAQ, we went to five cities over the course of 18 months. And we brought together not only representatives from those four key players in the supply chain, but also regulators, fraudsters, investors, academics, researchers, financial press, just a whole host of different people in each of those five venues where we had this discussion. And in every venue, the importance of Sarbanes-Oxley, even in London, they acknowledge the importance of some of the reforms in Sarbanes-Oxley. And, you know, Bob ticked through them all, including, I might add, the independence rules, separating the audit from the advisory side on the external auditors was all pointed to as key drivers to help deter and detect financial statement fraud, and really from the investor perspective, as well as from those in the supply chain, just critical components to increase everybody's awareness and performance. So I think that it was an important turning point for the detection and deterrence of financial statement fraud, because it acknowledges that everybody has a role to play, that the four key players have some responsibility, and it put it all in one place.
Yeah, I think the only thing that it didn't call out specifically, and it really wouldn't have been appropriate, was internal audit, because that's not, you know, a universal requirement for a public company to have that function. But if it was, my guess is there would have been something in there for them too.
And then, the other thing that was in Sarbanes-Oxley was the creation of the PCAOB and the oversight role that they play.
That's not an insignificant element here. Although the focus of the standard-setting agenda of the PCAOB, at least so far, has not been, front and center on the fraud standard, which at the time the PCAOB was formed, if I recall, this would have been SAS 99, was relatively new.
That had just been done.
So, but in the group that Joe and I served on together, that was often a conversation: is what about the fraud standard, and is it okay or not? And I think it's still sort of on the horizon. It's just not front and center on the agenda today.
That's my sense. Yeah,
Bob. Earlier in the context of the discussion on the expectations gap, you talked about the need for the audit profession to make further progress with respect to approaches to detecting financial statement fraud. And I wanted to give you a chance now to talk a little bit about some of the innovations that you have seen recently introduced, or some that might be introduced in the near-term future.
Sure. I think, realizing that our profession, if you think about, as you focus on the audits of public companies, there are a number of very large firms that have 100 or more public company clients. And those are the firms that get inspected by our regulator, the PCAOB, each and every year. And then there are hundreds of other firms that audit public companies, some maybe with only, one or two clients that requires them to be registered. If you look at sort of the end of the market that I'm on, and that's the larger firms, there is a significant amount of R&D each and every year that's designed to do just as you suggest. How do we improve our performance? And some of the things that we've seen, and I'd say these are fairly universal across certainly the major firms, things like, journal entry testing tools, and all this is going to sound a little sort of nerdy and technical, but those kinds of things deployed, across a large practice can really make a difference in terms of effectiveness and consistency, along with things like file interrogation techniques, which are more sophisticated than, they were many years ago. And one of the things that I find to be particularly helpful, and I know every firm probably has a different version of this, but the one I'm used to is what I call it a risk profiling tool, where at least in our case, we use 70 different data streams in a tool that essentially predicts risk of fraud and risk of business failure for our clients, and we run it on a quarterly basis. And we can calibrate that tool with certain parameters, and if something falls outside the parameter, that requires the engagement team to sort of follow up and say, well, why is this relationship in the balance sheet or certain ratios in the income statement sort of outside the norm that we would have predicted? My sense is it heightens awareness of fraud risk, and it actually impacts your planning and your execution of the audit, because if you don't see it in the planning phase, you're probably not going to scope your audit properly or have the appropriate steps in execution. The next wave, though, I think will really be transformational in many ways. And I don't know how to explain it because it's a little bit beyond me, but the explosion of the use of data analytics, which can be very specific to a company or an aspect or an attribute that you're trying to test, is become sort of front and center for certainly all the consulting firms. I was at a program yesterday, and the IBM people were presenting it. Our own people at Deloitte Consulting are talking about it in a huge way. And it's being used for very sort of everyday applications, including neonatal units trying to predict certain conditions before they're evident to a nurse or a doctor. And I'm told they're extremely effective. If you can take data and have predictive ability, that that could be very powerful when I think about, you know, facing off against a potential fraud.
As we look ahead, what do you see as some of the most promising paths to enhancing the prevention and the detection of financial statement fraud? And I'd like to turn back to the four parties that were in this supply chain that Cindy initially mentioned, and see if we can talk about the answer to that question in the context of each party. So, Cindy, why don't you kick this off?
I'm happy to do that, Ira. In fact, what I'm going to say, though, as a preface to some of the work that we plan on doing is that we want to do it collaboratively with the four participants in the supply chain. And so we have partnered with Financial Executives International, representing the preparers or management, the National Association of Corporate Directors, representing boards of directors and audit committees, and the Institute of Internal Auditors, who, of course, represent internal audit function, to focus on what the future state might be like and where we might partner together to tackle some of these issues. And so we landed on four key areas that we're going to focus our collective work on, and that is, what are the preconditions that lead to fraud? That's the first one. And by that, I mean, what causes one person to commit fraud where another person who is faced with some of the same facts and circumstances don't? So this gets to kind of the behavioral and psychological aspects behind committing fraud. The second area we want to look at is skepticism. Certainly, external auditors have a professional requirement to bring skepticism into the process, but really shouldn't all of the parties be skeptical? And so how we talk a little bit about this internally is the bias of trust. You know, you do your due diligence to go on to an audit committee or to take on an audit client or to join a company, either an internal audit or as part of management. And so you don't expect after you've made that decision that there's going to be fraud there. And so how do you then, on your first day on the job, turn that around and have that skeptical mindset? So we want to explore ways around that. Also, we want to explore the impact of short-term focus. And so how do you mitigate the potential harms of short-termism? That certainly goes to the fraud triangle of the pressure to commit fraud. If you're under immense pressure to make your numbers, how do you make sure as an organization, be it from the audit committee, internal audit, external audit, or management side, that you're not also creating an incentive to commit fraud? And then finally, a little bit to Bob's point earlier, is the role of information technology. IT can certainly be both a tool to commit fraud and also an effective deterrent to fraud. And so we'd like to explore how IT can be used to help deter and detect financial statement fraud, particularly, I think, in this day and age where everything's done electronically. You know, we don't sit across from each other and look each other in the eyes and have a lot of that human interaction that we used to have that can be, I think, effective an effective tool, certainly, in deterring and detecting fraud. And so are there ways that you can use information technology to overcome what has become a very electronic-based society that we live in?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of interest in this topic, Arvin, a lot of people looking at it. Obviously, CAQ, based on what Cindy just said, is taking a lead in this. COSO has for many years, and they have a number of things in the pipeline, and there may be some things that they'll do together with CAQ. Bob talked about firm-specific initiatives. I'm sure if we had the other firms here, they'd be talking about things as well. And then the Treasury Advisory Committee on the auditing profession recommended that the PCAOB establish a National Fraud Center. It appears that they're going to do that. I believe they're going to name the director in the hopefully not too distant future. And so it'll be interesting to see what that group does. To me, Ira, the thing we need to do here, and candidly, the challenge always is data, right? The firms have the data, and what they're doing with that. Maybe Bob can speak to it. But to me, they have an incredibly rich set of data, right, because they have thousands of audits every year for many years. And so to me, one of the things you want to look at is here's a set of proposed adjusting entries, in some cases maybe fraudulent, most cases not, most cases error-driven. But I'm sure there are situations where the firms do detect fraud and prevent it before a K or a Q is filed. How did they do that? Are some audit procedures more effective? Are there differences in people? What makes one auditor more effective than another in detecting fraud? Are there institutional arrangements in terms of supervision, in terms of incentives? What works? They also have access to their work papers when a fraud occurs, and they didn't catch it. Well, why didn't they catch it? What failed? What were the client characteristics that were present there that we might all say are risk factors, but not all risk factors are necessarily equally diagnostic? And so which ones are really diagnostic and which ones aren't? Now, you know, obviously Bob will respond to this. The firms are in business, you know, to make money. And, you know, as you and I both know, basic research is quite expensive. On the other hand, they have a powerful incentive to be better at this, because at a minimum you would think that their litigation exposure would go down and their regulatory exposure would go down. So I don't know what they're doing in this domain. I would hope that they're doing a lot. If they are, they're not sharing it widely to the world, and maybe they want to keep it inside for their own competitive purposes, which is fine. I understand that. I think some of the leaders in the firms, and Bob and Cindy would certainly be consistent with this, have wanted to enable this kind of research by outsiders, right? Because academics do bring a certain objectivity to the process, if nothing else, and we do this for a living. But there are a lot of obstacles, a lot of barriers to sharing the data outside. But they can do a lot inside, and for that matter, PCAOB can do a lot inside. And I'm not sure that some of these things that I'm suggesting are being done as extensively as I would like. But I hope Bob will tell me I'm wrong.
Well, I think, Joe, to your point, the firms certainly from time to time get pretty rich information by analyzing, you know, audits that maybe failed to detect something. You know, the question of much broader looks at adjusting journal entries, things like that, and the ability to somehow harvest that data and do some independent research could be valuable. But I find that in looking at a handful of situations, that, you know, there are certain common attributes or elements that cause us to sort of rethink how we do things and, you know, reexamine our own quality controls from time to time. I mean, the setup of the question about, you know, what is the most promising path? I got to tell you, and I look at the report that we've mentioned a couple of times now, the Platform for Action on Deterring and Detecting Financial Reporting Fraud. One of the things I think is the most promising is to take the equivalent of what we in my profession call professional skepticism, and instill that same, maybe you have to call it something different, but I think in the report we just use that as a surrogate for the same kind of skeptical probing questioning that that audit committees would do, that, you know, members of management would do with the data that, you know, if I'm running the accounting department or I'm assistant controller and my team is providing me data, I'm not going to just accept that and send it to my boss. I'm going to sit down and be very, you know, critically review that and make sure it's right. So I have to have that same skepticism. And the same is true, of course, of internal audit as well as the external auditor. My point is that if everyone had that mindset and it was being exercised at a concurrent time, I think we would greatly enhance the ability to detect fraud. I mean, I just think that's a direction we should head.
I agree with Bob completely, Ira, but I think the challenge, at least from where I sit, is, again, going back to what I said, if the fraud is a large-scale fraud and it's driven by the C-suite, they're not obviously going to be skeptical of something they know they're doing. So you can basically kind of wipe top management off the list. So they're off the table. And then so if I'm a CEO or CFO and I'm going to be perpetrating a massive fraud, the last thing I want is a strong internal audit group. So and I control that, right? So I either understaff it, under budget it, make sure that the people there are directed elsewhere, right? At Health South, they weren't looking at the financial statements. They were looking to see whether restrooms and their facilities were clean, you know, have them doing operational audits. So there's lots of ways to defang them. And so who's left at the end of the day? Who's the free safety? It's the external auditor. And one of the things that worries me a little bit, and this is not the profession's fault, is that whenever we go into an economic downturn, there's tremendous pressure on fees. And you could argue that that's where the risk of fraud is greatest. And that's a problem. And I don't think that's a problem that the profession can solve. Obviously, the profession doesn't think that's a good idea. I'm not sure the PCAOB can directly solve that. I do think there is a role here for the SEC, and I hope they're looking at that.
Well, the one group that really plays a central role on the fee side is the Audit Committee of the Board. And they're part of Cindy's four-party supply chain as well.
Quick point to Joe's point about the availability of research. I think that the collaboration that we're entering into with FEI, the IIA, and the NACD might loosen some of that up as well. I mean, as you all know, the CAQ has tried to fund independent research, and yes, it's, you know, five or six projects at a time, so it doesn't totally solve the problem. But both the FEI and the IIA have large research foundations. And so if we all partner together, I'm hopeful and optimistic that we can look at some of these issues, Joe, that you talked about. You know, what were the near misses? What worked? What didn't work? And how can we talk about it? So I am optimistic that we can make real movement there.
And Cindy, I'm very appreciative of everything you've done. But I think as Ira and I have both said, I think I've heard Ira say this as well, the biggest impediment isn't money. I mean, academics are always happy to take money, as is anybody else. But the biggest impediment isn't money. The biggest impediment is data and subjects.
Well, and I do believe that, just to balance it out, there is no question that the large firms, I mean, maybe there's no sort of ready repository of all this data, but certainly on a project-by-project basis, we often cooperate on the proposals we get. I think it's helpful that the CAQ, I mean, Cindy, you said you tried. Well, you've been successful funding some good research. And you know, the profession really has to support these efforts one way or another. And I think we'll continue to do so best we can.
So just a little inside humor here. The record should reflect that I did not put Joe up to answering that question that way. And there's two humorous elements to that, but I'll leave that at that. I did want to come back to professional skepticism for a moment, because that's come up in a couple of contexts here. And this, to me, is an area where there's a huge need for some of the members of the academic community to work with the four groups that are part of this supply chain. This is a concept that's been around a long time. One only need review a few inspection reports from the PCAOB to see that it's often a cited issue. And yet, I, as an instructor in the auditing arena, struggle when a student asks me, so how do I become a professional skeptic superstar? What can I really do that is going to make me stand out? So this is an area and that academics could play a role, because not only is this concept present in the auditing arena, but it's present in many other arenas. If you talk to people that do police work, if you talk to journalists, just to mention a few, even medical doctors have a notion of skepticism. So there's an opportunity to draw from a wide variety of fields, which could be part of the academics' comparative advantage. So now, with that commercial out of the way, I'd like to ask about practical steps that audit committees and boards might take to promote deterrence and detection of financial reporting fraud. And we'll kick this off initially by asking Joe to weigh in.
Well, I think there's a number of practical steps that audit committees and boards can take in this space, Ira. One thing that I think is important and that hasn't gotten enough attention is the board nomination and selection process. I have some work with a couple of academics that's forthcoming in an academic journal, and one of the things we look at is how do people get on boards, and basically the prior research finds that audit committee independence and expertise, which are important components of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, are helpful in many areas in terms of improving financial reporting. But what we find is given greater CEO involvement and how individuals get on the board and the audit committee, those benefits not only are reduced, they're eliminated. There's no effect at all. So the nominating governance process, I think, is very important, and sometimes I think doesn't get enough attention. So I think that's one thing that can be done. I think we need to pay more attention to comp committees. I think we need to pay more attention to incentives. Incentives matter an awful lot. And if the incentives are so skewed toward making numbers, there's always going to be that pressure to begin with. You're just creating a very high-risk situation where some people are going to give in to those temptations. So I think we need to look at that. I agree with what Bob and Cindy have said earlier. In terms of the role of boards and audit committees in particular in being more involved in owning this process. Now, in fairness to them, they're part-time organization, part-time bodies, and they're going to have to rely primarily on the external auditor and the internal auditor and, at the end of the day, management. And if you have a CEO and a CFO who are bound and determined to commit fraud, it's going to be very difficult. If it's hard for the external auditor, it's going to be extremely difficult for an audit committee who's there four or five or six times a year to detect it. But there are things that they can do that doesn't guarantee detection but helps, right? One is supporting the external auditor, in terms of scope of the audit, the fee, not looking for the, you know, saving the last dollar on the fee. I think that's very short-sighted and foolhardy. Ensuring that the necessary investment and controls are put in place, that there's a competence among the finance and accounting and information technology people. I think there's a role for the board and the audit committee to not be primarily passive receivers of information, which often in the past has been the norm. I've heard audit committees describe this as death by PowerPoint. And so they should have those agendas and those briefing books in advance and go through them in advance. And really the value of the meeting is to ask questions. That's really where it's important. And one audit committee member who I've talked to, I thought he had a great quote. He said to me one time, I view dissent as an obligation. And so this is getting at what Bob and Cindy talked about earlier, and that is essentially – I don't know if you want to call it professionally skeptical because there's not a body of literature for audit committee members like there is for external auditors, but it's the same thing, right? It's basically challenging the information you're given, challenging management, for that matter, challenging the external auditor. And I think when you have that, I think you end up with a more robust dialogue, and I think you have a better chance. There's, you're not going to be foolproof, but I think you're moving in the right direction.
Yeah, Joe, to your point, the National Association of Corporate Directors just issued a Blue Ribbon Commission report on the role of the Audit Committee, and they touched on many of these points, the importance of the Audit Committee being connected to the Compensation Committee, either through having overlapping members or attending each other's meetings, having the time to be able to really probe. And to your point about death by PowerPoint, the recommendation in there is that you expect that people will have read the board books before you go in there, and that you don't spend your meeting talking about what's in the board book, but rather focusing on issues that were raised in the board book, having just an expectation and an atmosphere that there's going to be this questioning mindset and that it's expected that people are going to probe and push and question so that that's the expectation, and people come in, they're prepared. And then also to some of the points that we've made earlier about how the audit committee's not there all of the time, well, maybe they should be there more, both informally and formally. So maybe if it's a manufacturing company that has plants in different locations, the audit committee members should go visit the plants and talk to employees.
Right.
Maybe they should have private meetings with the external auditor, of course, but also the internal auditor. So just really setting an atmosphere, and that takes the leadership. That takes the leadership of your audit committee chair. He or she has to run the agenda, run the meeting, and make sure that there's ample time to have these probing, pressing questions.
You know, Cindy, and to your point and Joe's points, it's certainly hard to disagree. I think of it sort of in simple terms, though, that the very first step is to have board members, audit committee members acknowledge that fraud can happen, you know, at this company or, you know, at any company. And I think we all acknowledge that board members certainly believe the organization that they've associated themselves with has integrity, and that there's sort of this, you know, predisposition to trust one another. And I think of, you know, all that you go through to get on a board and all the diligence you do to make sure that, you know, the reputation of the individuals in charge and the company as a public entity, you know, is of high quality. So, I mean, once you've done all that, you come in and sort of, you know, you're predisposed to, predisposed to trust what you're seeing. At the same time, having the knowledge that management override is the one of the those real, you know, real worries at any company, given the stats you were citing earlier, Joe, about how often top people are involved. So, I mean, I do think that the way that's why I keep coming back to skepticism. So the board, the audit committee has to understand the fraud triangle, the things that motivate, you know, pressure, opportunity, and rationalization, and really spend their time on some of the mitigating factors, culture, skepticism, and communication. Those are the, you know, the some of the best sort of anti-fraud elements. So, you know, even corroboration. I mean, people say, how do you remain skeptical? Well, I corroborate a lot of things. You know, I hear it from Sally, but I'm going to go find out separately from Joe, you know, whether what Sally's telling me is the right thing. And, you know, the techniques we use in the audit world are really applicable in business generally if you want to maintain sort of a mindset of skepticism. And it doesn't always have to be, you know, obvious to your client personnel that you're being skeptical, but you find ways to corroborate, to verify, you know, take a completely different angle at the same issue or problem, and sometimes you hear different things, at which point you've got to run that down. So I don't know. I do think that audit committees are in a tough spot on the one hand, but really have to develop a set of skills that any of us would want in that situation.
The recently completed CAQ study on financial statement fraud has come up several times today already, but I did want to give you, Cindy, in particular, a chance to comment on anything that we might not have discussed yet.
The one area that emerged in our various discussions and that you'll see as a key theme in the report that we've not yet touched upon today is the importance of tone at the top. And we use that as shorthand, but really what we're talking about there is a strong ethical tone and a strong corporate culture that permeates the entire organization. So if we're going to keep with our alliterations, it's not just tone at the top, it's mood at the middle and the buzz at the bottom, if you will, that it really has to, of course, it starts at the top, and it's key that the CEO and the CFO and the other C-level executives are committed to a strong culture of ethics within an organization, but they have to not just pay lip service to it, they have to live it and breathe it. And one way to do that is to have a strong whistleblower in ethics program within an organization. I think that we've all seen statistics that the richest resource for detecting fraud is through whistleblowers. And so at the same time, many employees within an organization do not feel confident that if they do use the hotline or if they do raise the red flag, that it will be taken seriously and that they won't be retaliated against. And so it's really important that I think companies, then supported by internal and external auditors as well as the audit committee, really focus on, does the company have a strong ethical culture within the organization, and do they really live it? And so we talk a lot about that in the report. I'll just put that as a marker down, that that's really important, and we've not spent much time talking about it.
I think in the interest of time, I'm going to move on to a related but somewhat different focus. We've covered a lot of turf here. Much of what we've covered has, I believe, major educational implications. So I'd like each of you, we'll start with Joe, to share with us your views on what the most significant educational implications are of a desire to increase auditors' capacity to detect financial statement fraud.
I think there's a lot there, Ira, and in the interest of time, I'll just hit on a couple of things. I think one thing is that there needs to be more of a focus on experiential-based learning. I think it's very hard to really teach someone how to detect fraud just based purely on, you know, reading textbooks and lectures and so forth. And so I think experiential-based learning is very important. I think graduate education is critical. In most of the states, there's a 150-hour law, but it can be 30 hours of essentially anything. And so I think good graduate programs are critical. I'm not convinced necessarily that 1 year is sufficient. Law is a three-year program. Medicine is four plus many internships and residencies and so forth. And it's just, you know, if you think about a typical education program, you know, they'll have an auditing class at the undergraduate level, maybe an auditing class at the graduate level. And I'm just not sure that's efficient. But probably the last thing I'll hit on is the composition of us, Ira, and that is it's increasingly dominated by people who are really trained, you know, financial economists, financial accounting researchers who have tremendous skills in finance and mathematics and statistics. Many of these people with no practical experience, no institutional knowledge whatsoever, no ties to the profession. And I just think it's very hard to train the next generation of auditors if that's who's going to be educating them. Now, again, that's a generalization. There's lots of exceptions to that. And the profession, I think, is aware of this, and they've taken some steps to try to deal with that in terms of the pipeline, particularly in the area of auditing and tax. But that's going to be a long process, and I think it's something we need to keep our eye on.
You know, let me pile on a little bit. I think the the quality of our sort of new hires on the, you know, we recruit right out of college with brand new degrees is very high. We obviously, to deploy them in an audit capacity, have a training obligation of our own because we need to teach our own methodologies and some of the real fundamentals. But I would observe 150 hours, you know, precious little of that is used in the auditing arena. There's a lot of accounting. You know, everybody takes a tax course and everybody takes an auditing course, but typically that's it. And I'm sort of amazed because, in my view, the skill sets you get from auditing education is utilized whether or not you spend your life being an auditor or not. In other words, you could be a management accountant, you could be in a number of different capacities in the financial world, in the accounting world, and I don't think any time spent on auditing education, auditing courses, is really wasted. So if I had to pick one thing, I would say a little more time in the auditing coursework.
I'll play clean up on that particular question with much more practical advice, and that would be to the students out there in particular, don't lose your enthusiasm and don't, you know, whatever role you go into, I think it's hard for young people to keep their voice because they're afraid they're going to ask the dumb question or that there must be a reason this isn't being done because people more experienced than I would have done it. And a lot of times that's true, but a lot of times sometimes that's not true. And so it sounds hokey, but my dad always told me that the only stupid question was the question that you didn't ask. And so I would leave students with that. And that, you know, keep that questioning mindset. And because even if it's not going to help you uncover a fraud, it's going to help you learn. So that would be my advice.
Thank you. Well, unfortunately, we've almost come to the end of our allotted time. So Cindy, Joe, and Bob, thank you very much for this most thoughtful discussion. Both today's program and the October 14th chat on regulation in the audit profession will be important materials in the collection on accounting in the Virtual Museum and the Archives Collection. The audio of today's broadcast is now available on www.sechistorical.org, and a transcript will be ready soon. I invite you to visit the dedicated Deloitte Fireside Chat section under Programs at www.sechistorical.org at any time, where you'll be able to access not only this month's programs, but also the 2009 Fireside Chats on Professional Judgment and on Principles versus Rules-Based Accounting and Auditing Standards. These programs, along with the other 4,000-plus materials in the museum, are free and accessible to you at all times. On behalf of the SEC Historical Society, I'd like to thank Deloitte LLP for its sustained support and assistance in making today's program possible, and the Deloitte Fireside Chat series as well. Thank you for being with us today, and good afternoon.